Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Ellie MacArthur. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. On Saturday, January 24th, the Kingston Symphony is inviting audiences to experience one of film's most iconic musical universes, with a concert that dives deep into the legendary scores of Star Wars, from the nine canon films to The Mandalorian, Rogue One, and beyond. From the instantly recognizable themes by John Williams to the newer additions, the music of Star Wars promises a night of cinematic sound at the Kingston Grand Theatre. I spoke with music director Evan Mitchell about this upcoming show in the Symphony's Pop series and why the music of Star Wars continues to resonate generations later.
You've played pieces from Star Wars before, but I don't think ever like this. What made you want to do a full deep dive into the Star Wars universe?
Well, taking a look at things in the aggregate, I've always believed that large-scale cinematic universes, if you'll pardon that term, I know it gets overused quite a bit, they become fairly common. And musically speaking, I would say the one that has the most rich, most impactful, dare I say, the best music is the Star Wars universe. And that's something we've wanted to celebrate for some time. And as a result, given that desire and given the enormous volume of music that exists for the Star Wars universe, it felt like a pretty natural decision.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the most recognizable music worlds in pop culture. What do you think it is about these scores that makes them work so powerfully?
I think an awful lot of credit needs to be given to John Williams. In the original set of Star Wars films, he created a sound world, but even more specifically, a set of musical themes that would define the musical nature of Star Wars at large. And that's something that other composers have had to grapple with, but they've brilliantly added their own stamp onto things as Star Wars has evolved over the decades. But because John Williams started it all and wrote so many incredible themes, I think that has sort of become part of the DNA of Star Wars, musically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that has been a significant reason why the music is so memorable and so closely associated to Star Wars at large.
Mm-hmm. And kind of diving a bit deeper into what you were saying there, everything's very grounded in that original series score. But I was wondering if you could also speak to how it's kind of changed and evolved. I'm sure looking at all these pieces together over the long span of the series has been interesting for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, particularly take a look at the way things spaced out over the course of since the original trilogy, which spanned from roughly 1977 to 1983, and then going on to the prequel trilogy, which actually had quite a lot of amazing music. That's, I want to say, 1999. To 2000, early 2000s. And then, of course, more than a decade after that, I want to say Force Awakens was about 2016, if memory serves. So there's a huge amount of time for the canon, the nine canon films, spanning from, 1977, spanning essentially 45 years. And so that's all musical extensions of the same story, which involved using the same musical themes for the characters who remain and evolve and grow over the course of those nine films, but also a lot of new and original themes written for the most recent three films. And in the J.J. Abrams trilogy, Force Awakens, and onward. So it's really interesting. But then beyond that, we have the rest of the cinematic universe, the TV series, the the films that are sort of take place in the nooks and crannies of the Star Wars universe that aren't part of that Skywalker story. The Han Solo film, of course, Rogue One being the very first film, I think, for based on that was in the Star Wars universe that was not including music by John Williams. That's a Michael Giacchino score. We're going to be playing some music from that. The Mandalorian thing was a turning point for what Star Wars could be as part of that television series. We're including music from that as well. And so it's really a quite a tapestry that we're presenting for the Star Wars musical universe at large.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is different about hearing this music with the full live orchestra compared to experiencing it on the screen or through soundtracks?
Well, first and foremost, by putting the focus on the music and by having it be part of a live concert, music for film and television, by definition, is there as sort of an accompanying aspect. It's there to elevate the film. It's there to enrich an emotional experience or a visceral experience. Or its absence is often there to sort of pinpoint something emotionally in the film. But the point being is that it's, I don't want to say that it's secondary to the film, but it's in service to the film. And when we have the concert proper, when you're just hearing this music and then that becomes the focus, first off, it means you have a little bit more freedom in being able to interpret how fast or slow something should go. Mm-hmm. You're not worrying about having in sync to a picture and to the vision of the director from a cinematography perspective, but it just becomes pure music. And the best film television music stands on its own merits. And of course, all the music that we're going to be performing does that and then some. And so it will draw people into the rich harmonic and sonic soundscapes that the various composers were conjuring up to bring us ever deeper into this world.
And from the podium, I was wondering, what's the biggest difference between conducting film music like this and a traditional classical program?
I wouldn't say there's that much of a difference, particularly if you take a look at John Williams' writes in the grand symphonic tradition. It's really not all that different from conducting a piece from the Romantic era. I think good music is good music. This, I have the extra consideration of thinking about what does this particular passage represent in the film, and do I want to sort of bring that out? Do I want to highlight a character or highlight a sound world or these sorts of things as it relates to the experience of watching it? Because I think a lot of people, what's going to happen is that they'll hear, for example, the opening fanfare, the iconic fanfare. And for them, that will represent the title crawl or the opening of each film, just like the point of introduction to this grand space opera, the opening of it all, you know. So I think about those sorts of things, but it's really, I don't have to stray too far from my quote-unquote classical training, shall we say, because it's music is very much written in that vein. It just has a specialized purpose originally in mind. And so as long as I'm thinking about that also, then it's very similar.
And what can audiences expect walking into this concert next weekend?
It's a celebration of the music that they know and love. It's a celebration of a great cross-section of the entire Star Wars universe. As I've mentioned, we include all nine of the music from all three of the trilogies. We have music from The Mandalorian. We have music from Rogue One. So it's, in a sense, it's an attempt to showcase some of the very best and most memorable and beloved music from this franchise performed live. And there's something about a live performance, of course, as we all know, it's an experience unto itself. So just going to have a great time. And we're going to be having a great time as well, being immersed in such wonderful music. It's a concert we're all looking forward to.
And you don't have to answer specifically if you feel like it'd be too much of a spoiler, but I was wondering if you personally had any tracks that you're specifically really looking forward to.
Look, I love all this music, and I was the one who put this program together. So I will often curate things that I think people want to hear this and people should hear this. That's my primary concern rather than I want to perform this. But there's so much wonderful music from just this. It's an incredible treasure trove of just hours upon hours upon hours of music. And we're really lucky that it's been published in its original format. That's something to bear in mind, that we're not doing reductions or arrangements of this music. This is all from the signature series of Star Wars music. So these are the original cues from the films. And the way that you hear them will be the way that you remember them from the films. So I will say that I'm particularly impressed with how John Williams was able to continue his sort of excellence with the most recent trilogy of films. You will be performing some music from The Force Awakens. And I think that some of the best music in the Star Wars universe was composed for The Force Awakens. And so it's going to be a particular joy for me to be able to showcase that.
That was Evan Mitchell, music director with the Kingston Symphony. The music of Star Wars takes place Saturday, January 24th, 2026 at the Kingston Grand Theater as part of the Symphony's Pops series. Tickets are available at kingstonsymphony.ca or through the Grand Theater box office. The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of 5 targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into 5 key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council, co-chair Ellen Mortfield and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowitt sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these kind of targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably, 14, 15 producers?
Yeah. And really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowitt says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
We did begin, maybe I'll step back for a second, right, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to, you know, contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you were referring to, and then, you know, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentations, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With, you know, with the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, it became clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, you know, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experienced with respect to, you know, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening. And that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, you know, food is really sort of, the food system's often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy, you know, like health has a piece over here and then maybe agriculture somewhere else. And often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever, there often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system to coming together. The focus group similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of, you know, specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, you know, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, you know, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, you know, farmers being more, you know, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want. Really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, that need to convene and hopefully feel like, I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system and a more kind of food sovereign, you know, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
We'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions and these focus groups have started to, you know, I've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from CASI, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative, in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right? That gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Lori.
Thank you, Chris. This is Henry Walker with your Queens Campus News here on CFRC 101.9's Campus Beat. Queen's University is among 6 Ontario post-secondary institutions receiving provincial funding to support the expansion of primary care teaching clinics. Under the Provisional Primary Care Action Plan, a total of $8 million has been allocated for planning new and expanded clinic operations, which aim to connect more patients with family doctors and interdisciplinary healthcare teams. Queen's operates Family Health Team primary care clinics in Kingston, Belleville, and Oshawa, and the recent funding will support planning work at each site. The initiative is intended to improve access to primary care while training future health professionals, including resident physicians and other practitioners working in team-based care settings. In related provincial news, the Government of Ontario has announced a significant investment in colleges and universities, with $242 million designated for upgrading facilities and institutional equipment across the province. The announcement was made in Kingston by the Minister of Colleges, Universities, Research Excellence, and Security. Most of the funding is allocated through the Facilities Renewal Program, which supports maintenance and repair on-campus buildings. Additional funds will help purchase modern instruction and training equipment. Officials say the investment is intended to better align post-secondary institutions with workforce needs in sectors such as healthcare, trades, and education. On January 14th, Queen's University held a ceremony to honor Chancellor Emeritus and former Senator Murray Sinclair. Sinclair, the first Indigenous Chancellor in Queen's history, was recognized for his long-standing work in promoting reconciliation and Indigenous justice. The event drew attention from both the Queen's community and broader civic audiences, making a connection of the university's efforts to recognize leadership in equity and community service. In Kingston municipal politics, a recently published commentary has urged caution in adopting online voting for the upcoming 2026 municipal election. The piece argues that while online voting may expand accessibility, it also raises unresolved concerns around cybersecurity, equity, and trust in electoral outcomes. Local residents and policy analysts will likely continue this debate as municipal councils consider options ahead of the election. The Kingston area continues to see development proposals, with plans being discussed for a high-volume residence project downtown on a block formerly home to a McDonald's and Blockbuster video store. The proposal, described by municipal officials as consistent with the city's intensification goals, has promoted debate among community members about height, density, and heritage impacts in the core. Looking ahead, Queen's University's Department of Gender Studies is hosting the 2026 SXGD Lecture on January 28th at Robert Sutherland Hall. The talk, delivered by Dr. Natalie Curry-Tau, will explore institutional dynamics of safety and power in higher education. Also in the coming days, the Kingston Grand Theatre continues performances of Into the Woods, now running through January 20th, offering cultural programming that attracts both students and community audiences. I've been Henry with your Queen's Campus News here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We start with Monday, January 19th, daytime high of minus 5, feeling closer to minus 16 with the wind chill. We're also looking at a little bit of snow overnight, could see 3 to 6 centimeters falling between late Sunday and the rest of the day Monday. Tuesday, January 20th, another very chilly day. Daytime high of minus 10, feeling closer to minus 20 with the wind chill, and another 1 to 3 centimeters in the forecast between Tuesday night and the morning of Wednesday, January 21st. Slightly warmer, minus 6, feeling like minus 15, with intermittent snow and flurries projected throughout the day. Thursday, January 22nd, daytime high of minus 6 with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to minus 11 with the wind chill. Friday, January 23rd, a little bit colder, daytime high of minus 9. But we will see less wind chill, so in the sun at the peak of the day, it'll actually feel a little closer to minus 4, even if the temperature is technically forecasted to be lower than Thursday. Saturday, January 24th, minus 8 is your high. Snowy, cold, feeling like minus 17. Sunday, January 25th, minus 14 with a wind chill feeling closer to minus 20. Little bit of sun, mostly clouds in the forecast. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 26th, high of minus 11, feeling like minus 20 with a 60% chance of snow in the forecast as well. This week's City of Kingston traffic report has very little to report, but I do want to remind our listeners that the full winter parking restrictions went into effect on January 1st. During January and February, overnight on-street parking is not permitted, no matter the weather conditions. That will change in March, where overnight on-street parking will be banned only if the weather and conditions require it, so think particularly snowy or icy evenings. When restrictions are in place, parking on city streets is prohibited from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. On the streets surrounding Kingston General Hospital, the ban runs from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. Vehicles left on the street during bans are subject to ticketing and towing. To learn more about parking restrictions, how they work, and to stay informed, you can visit the City of Kingston website.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services,
What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.